Good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming to this Adelaide Writers' Week event. My name is Sian Kane. I'm the Deputy Culture Editor for The Guardian Australia, we are gathered on the lands of the Kaurna people. Sovereignty was never ceded, and I'm deeply grateful to be here on their lands, and I extend my respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who may be here today. And I grew up not far from here, so it's so lovely to be at this festival, which is, I think, one of the best literary festivals in Australia. So thank you very much for joining. So we have two absolutely amazing writers here this morning to speak to you. So we have Anna Funder, who rose to prominence with her book Stasiland, and then the novel All That I Am, here today to speak about her genre-defying book, Wifedom, about the life of Eileen Blair, who is the wife of the writer George Orwell, whose work in the Spanish Civil War has been widely underappreciated. And also Sarah Watling, who holds a degree in history from the University of Cambridge and a master's degree in historical research from the University of London. Tomorrow, Perhaps the Future is her second book, and takes in some of the greatest women journalists, writers and thinkers who played roles in the Spanish Civil War. Please join me in welcoming them today. So it's perhaps good to speak about the shared setting for both of these books, for at least part of Anna's book, which is the Spanish Civil War. And Sarah, could you perhaps begin with a reading from your book, because it gives sort of the extra context for anyone that's not aware of the sort of the wider historical, events around the start of this war.
Sure. Hi, everyone. The Spanish War began in July 1936. When a group of disaffected generals, including Francisco Franco, who would emerge as their leader, attempted to launch a coup against their country's elected government. The reaction of foreign powers was significant from the start. Fascist Italy and Nazi Germany offered decisive material support to Franco's side, the nationalists, while the Republican government received from its fellow democracies in France, the United States, and Great Britain only a queasy refusal to intervene. As the Republic battled to survive this well-resourced attack, relying on a tenacious popular resistance to the military takeover and on arms from Soviet Russia and Mexico, many observers understood the war as an opportunity to halt the global advance of fascism, one that their own government seemed loath to take up. Some months in, Nancy Cunard challenged her fellow writers to make public statements on the war in an urgent call that framed things like this. It is clear to many of us throughout the world that now, as certainly never before, we are determined or compelled to take sides. The equivocal attitude, the ivory tower, the paradoxical, the ironic detachment will no longer do. This was where the Spanish Civil War began to matter to me. It happened that when I first read this eye-catching statement, I was living through an era of national and international upheaval that made Nancy's 80-year-old challenge snatch up my attention. It was possible, in her day, to see democracy as a teetering edifice, a system that had outlived or even failed its potential. Alternatives vied for dominance. The Great Depression in America, that citadel of capitalism, had not only destabilized economies around the world, but shaken faith in the capitalist system itself, proving to some minds the validity of the Marxist theory that had predicted its collapse. The 20s and early 30s had seen military dictators or non-democratic forms of government gain the upper hand in a raft of countries. Hungary, Poland, Yugoslavia, Romania, Japan, Portugal, Austria, Bulgaria, Greece, and of course, even earlier in Russia. By 1936, Germany and Italy had been governed by fascists for years. Their regimes found plenty of sympathizers in countries shaken by the First World War and the ensuing Depression. The British Union of Fascists, for example, was already almost 4 years old. Nor was fascist aggression on the international stage something new. Italy had invaded Ethiopia in 1935. Germany was openly remilitarizing, something forbidden by the terms of the peace imposed at the end of the First World War. For some, the great dichotomy of the 1930s was provided by fascism and communism. For many others, including those who weren't convinced of a meaningful difference between the two, Spain was perhaps simpler still: fascism or opposition to fascism. By my day, it had become fairly common to hear people drawing dark parallels with the 1930s, that decade in which Mussolini and Hitler crushed opposition and raised their armies, and Franco took over Spain, and black shirts marched in the streets of London. We thought we knew these facts, but it seemed they were losing their power to terrify or forewarn, that acknowledging them belonged to an old tyranny of decency and truth that others were ready to throw off.
So the Spanish Civil War, you know, from the name of it, perhaps if someone doesn't know the history that led to that point, they may assume that perhaps, you know, this is a war that is entirely constrained to Spain. But, you know, the thing that's so significant about it is the, certainly in your book, is the presence of these international volunteers and international fighters that went to Spain because they saw it as a point at which that they could see off the spread and the growth of fascism, even though it was, you know, already present in Germany and Italy and increasingly in Russia as well. That could you speak about your sort of cast of writers, because there's so many writers, and obviously there were writers in Spain and that were writing about this war, but it's so interesting that there were so many international writers all over the world that were taking a particular interest in this war.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very difficult to understand the motivation for a lot of the foreigners who went to Spain. You have to understand the context of appeasement and the appeasement policy, whereby, you know, the major democracies in the West were ceding a lot of ground to fascists in the hope of kind of avoiding another war. And that was something that felt very contemporary to me, the fact that there are a lot of, young, politically active people who are seem much more aware of the urgency of the situation than their governments appear to be. And that puts them in a very particular position of having to kind of, you know, we're so used to thinking that there are grown-ups in the room who are going to kind of deal with these things for us. And this is a generation that is coming to realize that their governments are not going to do what they think is necessary to do. Mm-hmm. And that leaves them with the question, well, what should I do then? You know, it becomes a kind of a matter of personal conscience in a kind of new way. And I mean, I say very explicitly in the introduction to the book that this isn't a book about Spaniards. I wanted to be very clear that, you know, it's not a kind of new history of the Spanish Civil War in the sense that it doesn't include the voices of Spaniards, and you couldn't write a history of the Spanish Civil War without them. Mm. What my book is interested in is exactly this phenomenon of outsiders coming to identify with Spain and what meaning Spain took on for them and how their experience of solidarity and how they tried to enact allyship was complicated by the fact that they weren't Spanish, they didn't have exactly the same investment as the people that they were trying to kind of claim as their allies. And because fascism became a kind of catch-all term that meant a lot of different, anti-fascism as well became a catch-all term that meant a lot of different things to different people, these people were arriving with Spain with their own baggage, their own histories of activism, their own agendas. And that, in a way, was an amazing thing because it enabled this huge kind of upsurge of international solidarity. But there were also ways in which it could mean that they weren't very well educated about what had happened in Spain. There was always a risk that they could sort of drown out exactly the people whose voices they were trying to amplify. So I was really interested in that kind of tension. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if there were lessons, you know, allyship and solidarity is such an important thing for us today as well. I thought it would be interesting to see how other people had grappled with that question in the past. Mm.
And so in that passage that you just read from, there was the quote that you return to frequently in the book, which is the Nancy Cunard quote about sort of writers having to leave their ivory tower. But could you, introduce us to Nancy, but also, there's Martha Gellhorn, who some people may recognise her name, but also Sylvia Townsend Warner. Could you sort of just briefly introduce your writers?
Yeah, it depends how long we've got, because quite a lot of them. But Nancy Cunard was definitely kind of my entryway into the book, because obviously, you know, I was really interested in the Spanish Civil War, but I didn't really think that there was anything new to say about it necessarily until I discovered this pamphlet that Nancy Cunard had put together in 1937, which was called Authors Take Sides on the Spanish War. And what she'd done is she had sent this kind of questionnaire out to hundreds of eminent writers in Britain and Ireland, asking them very simply to state whether they supported the Republican side or the Nationalist side. And she said to them, you know, I'm asking you to do this, for it is impossible any longer to take no side. So I was really struck by that idea that things could sort of come to a pass in history, that neutrality is no longer an option, that we can't sort of take refuge in that idea of neutrality. And it raised so many questions for me, like, why is she asking writers particularly? Why does she think making a statement in of itself could be of any value? And also I was like, who is this woman? You know, like, this is such a bold move, and I feel like I know almost nothing about her. And so researching her kind of led me into the paths of all these other women. But to answer your actual question, Nancy Cunard was a fascinating figure who had, you know, she was born in great wealth. Her father was kind of British landed gentry. It was a classic marriage of, you know, British title to American money. So she had been raised by this extremely wealthy mother who was ran one of the kind of main literary salons in London. So she was surrounded by artists and writers her whole life. She was a real kind of it girl when the gossip magazines were really just kind of coming into their own in Edwardian Britain. And she really rebelled against all of that. She moved to Paris. She became involved with the Surrealists, with all the different kind of movements of artists and writers that were happening then. And she was also herself a poet and a publisher. She set up her own press, the Hours Press. And so she was somebody who was used to having a lot of attention and having a kind of media platform. But I think when we meet her in the book, she is really reaching a stage in her life when she is trying to harness that attention to her own ends in a new way. And as you say, there's also Martha Gellhorn. So I think Nancy was in her sort of 40s when the Spanish Civil War happened. Martha Gellhorn is in her late 20s. Spain is where she begins her career as a journalist, as a war correspondent. And I think one of the interesting things about that is that in Spain, you can see her kind of searching for a mode to kind of express what she's seeing. Sylvia Townsend Warner was, she was then, and I think still is, best known as the author of Lolly Willows, which is this kind of really charming sort of whimsical novel about a woman, a middle-aged woman who moves to the English countryside and becomes a witch. And so it's kind of beloved as this kind of whimsical tale, but it also has this really subversive undercurrent of like this woman kind of looking at the deal that bourgeois life offers women and realizing that like she can get a better deal from the devil, you know? So she is somebody who, and she's also, Sylvia Townsend Warner is one of the few people in the book who's a card-carrying communist, which is another thing that almost nobody knows about her. So she's someone who's quite good at kind of operating under the radar, and her radicalism isn't always kind of obvious, and that makes it in a way more kind of powerful. Yes. She can wield it in a more powerful way.
She's particularly fascinating. And so much of your book is about the writers that aren't sort of necessarily household names or known for their involvement in the Spanish Civil War. But so much of your book, Anna, has to do with George Orwell, who is obviously very famous for his writing about the Spanish Civil War. He occupies a particularly complex position in your book because so much of your book is actually about his wife, Eileen, and how she's been written out of his account of his time in the war. So I guess, would you perhaps introduce us to Eileen and do a little reading from the book?
Yeah, I can do. Hello, everyone. It's really lovely to be here in Adelaide. I am not at all an expert on the Spanish Civil War, so it's kind of slightly strange to find myself up here talking about it. They never stopped me before, so I will go for it. I had read Homage to Catalonia as a teenager and absolutely loved it. And then I came back and reread it when I was writing this book, and I loved it again. It's a fantastic read. It's such a visceral account of Orwell's time in the trenches in Aragon, in Spain. And I went to those trenches with the son that he and Eileen later adopted in 1944, and the son of his commander, who was known as a... they called him... I think you're not allowed to say this anymore, but they called him a fat man on a horse. But he was an unbelievably good and brave commander called George Kopp. So I went with the son of Orwell and Eileen and the son of Orwell's commander to these trenches as part of the research for this book, because I knew that there was going to be a Spanish Civil War section in it. When you read Homage to Catalonia, you get this very... kind of close-up view of what the fighting was like in the trenches. You know, on about the first page, Orwell confesses that you know, there are lice crawling up the inseam of his trousers and all over his testicles, and it's incredibly uncomfortable, and the water's disgusting, so they've resorted to washing in wine, which doesn't sound so terrible. But he paints this very vivid portrait of what the fighting was like. But after I'd read Homage to Catalonia and was working on this book, I went and read 6 biographies of Orwell. They were written between the early 70s and 2003. And in them, you learn that he goes to Spain and you learn about what happened in Spain, often based on his own account in Homage to Catalonia. But you learn just that his wife, Eileen O'Shaughnessy, went to Spain. You don't know anything about what she was doing there. In 2003, one of the biographers says, Eileen went to Spain. She wasn't political at all. She just went to be nearer her husband and to be able to find for him in Barcelona treats to send to the front, like chocolate, margarine and cigars. So that's what I thought was the case. What then happened was, as my husband points out to me, I spent longer trying to work out the Spanish section of this book than Orwell and Eileen spent in Spain, which is hugely embarrassing. But I had to kind of... what I found out that doesn't appear in any of the biographies is that Eileen had gone to Spain because she had a job in the headquarters of the political office of the International Labour Party, which was affiliated with the PUM, the Trotskyist party that Orwell was fighting for. So she's working in Barcelona at headquarters, and she's working organising supply of all the men's needs at the front and getting their mail from the front and back to the UK. So all communications which go through George Kopp, the Comandante on the horse. And she's incredibly well aware that there are Stalinist spies in her office. She works in that office for many months, almost the whole time that Orwell is there. When he's wounded, he's unbelievably bored because he's in a backwater of the front, and he keeps, by his own account, sticking his neck up. He was 6'2½", sticking his neck up above the trench. Really, I think, in an effort to try and get shot because he was so bored. And eventually he's successful and he's shot through the throat. And he spends 2,500 words in Homage to Catalonia telling us about his medical care after that, being shunted around like a bloody bag of bones on the back of trucks to field hospitals and things. He doesn't say that Eileen was immediately with him organising all of that care. And writing back to her brother in London, who was rather conveniently a thoracic surgeon, to find out what to do. So Orwell starts this omission of her very obviously in the book. So what I found was a woman who was at the epicentre of what was going on politically, who saved his life possibly when he was shot through the throat, but certainly when they had to get out. So she was the person who had to go at great danger during a Stalinist crackdown and get the visas from the prefecture of police, from which police were coming and killing people in the streets. She had to get their visas to get them out. So she does that. None of that would you learn from Homage to Catalonia, and none of it would you learn from 6 biographies. So I became unbelievably interested in what went on for Eileen, how it is that he can write a book. He was sending back notes for this book from the trenches on the backs of envelopes, bits of toilet paper, scraps of whatever he could find. And she was typing it up into a document that would become the basis for the book, Homage to Catalonia, which she then edited and effectively typed. She informed it, because he didn't know what was going on in the politics in Barcelona, and then she typed herself out of it. So that was my conundrum of many months, trying to find her, kind of reverse engineer Homage to Catalonia, to find the woman behind it, which I eventually did. I'm going to read a little scene that's 2.5 pages. My book has a kind of essay analysis, personal essay component, which is about this, what it took to find Eileen from under six biographies and Orwell's own elisions. But I got permission to use six letters of Eileen's in the book, which was really fantastic. So they are letters that she wrote to her best friend from when they were at Oxford together. And the letters date from the beginning of the marriage in 1936 to the end of the marriage in 1945. So I use those letters to write scenes in the book. This scene has no letters of Eileen, so none of her actual words, but it is, if you like, the inverse of the scene that Orwell describes in Homage to Catalonia of a Stalinist raid. So this is it. It's called In Plain Sight. The office is disbanded. Everyone's in prison. This is at a time where Stalin basically has control of the Spanish police and is rounding up other sorts of leftists that he doesn't want to have any power in this revolution. He's effectively quashing the leftist revolution that it looks like he's supporting, and he's killing PUM members, so compatriots of Orwell's other Spaniards in the party and their leaders. So Eileen's office is disbanded. Everyone's in prison. George is away somewhere. She sits most of each day and into the night in full view in the hotel lobby. She changes chairs, drinks tea, orders food she doesn't eat. She smokes and smokes. George will get off a train from the front, push his ragged frame through those gilded doors, and be arrested before he can blink. Every chair she sits in must have a view of the main entrance. It's not much of a plan, but it's all she has. He will walk in, she will get up and walk him out again. Hardly a plan at all. For all she knows, she may be luring him into a trap. One of the reception staff seems friendly, but you can never tell. Every time he picks up the phone, she gets a stab of terror in her belly and looks to see if the guards at the door are coming for her. The nights are the worst. If he's dead already, there's no office to let know. She wonders how long the news would take to reach her. She could be here night after night for no reason. She goes up to bed. Before she lies down, she checks under the mattress. Their passports and checkbook are still there. So she's put them there to hide them. Then she settles in like a hen on precious eggs. It's hard to sleep. She watches her thoughts as they come in. It's psychology 101. She was doing an MA in psychology when she met Orwell. It's her trick not to be overwhelmed by them. What she thinks now is that there are two fictions protecting her. The first, that nothing ever happens to Pig, her nickname. The second is the illusion that because she's done nothing wrong, she cannot be imprisoned. But democracy, like money, requires everyone to believe in it. Otherwise, the law is just flimsy paper, same as the checkbook and passports she's lying on. She drifts off, sleeping with her friends or rotting in some cellar, and she waits for the knock on the door. It might be George, or it might be... There it is. She sits up. The knock. Again. Not him, then. She opens to a blur, six of them, uniformed, three carrying crates. She puts her hands to her neck. The tie of her nightie is undone. As they wordlessly take up positions, she inches back slowly onto the bed, rests against the headboard. Her chest thumps, blood in her ears. An older man with a thick neck and grey in his moustache is barking orders. Another, just a boy really, a spray of pimples on his cheek, sneaks a look at her. She gestures to the nightstand. Then slowly she reaches over, picks up her glasses and puts them on. Buenos dias, she says. The men are moving, lifting, patting. The boy's hands are in her underwear drawer. He barely fills out his uniform, and here he is in a woman's bedroom at dawn, rifling through her smalls. The other men sense his shame and want to eliminate it. She pretends not to see, but she does. It shames them to see themselves reflected in the boy's black eyes, this boy who has not yet learned to distinguish a fascist from a POOM member, an order from something beyond the pale, a woman from an enemy of the cause. Desk drawers, the commander barks at him. So they go through this search. The commander, she glimpses a man in the bathroom feeling behind the cistern, bending to look under the bath, then hears him opening the cabinet, the clink of bottles being tipped into the basin. Another has upended the waste paper basket. A third is sounding the walls, God alone knows what for. A fourth has opened the wardrobe and is putting his hands in the pockets of Orwell's trousers and her cardigans. The commander stops. "This fascist," he says, holding up a copy of Hitler's Mon Combat, My Struggle. "Si," Eileen says, "para saber," in order to know. He keeps going. The boy has worked his way through the desk drawers, pulling out pens, ink, paper, rubber bands, stamps, notebooks, a torch, cigarette papers. A bloom of red is spreading up the back of his neck. "The cigarette papers," the commander says, "check them." The boy pulls out one cigarette paper till another and another, and there's a fluttering white pile on the desk. The men are there for 2 hours. She doesn't leave the bed. The three bearing crates go through the door first. The commander leaves last. "Senora," he says as he passes her. He doesn't close the door. Something rises in her throat. Every single thing in this room, every article and surface, has had their fingers on it. She goes to the bathroom and retches. Then she comes back, closes the door, and thinks.
So you mentioned before that obviously we don't know a huge amount about Eileen as a person, but you know, through the research of your research, what did you deduce about her motivations? Because you said that my sort of biographers generally wrote off her presence in the Spanish Civil War as sort of wanting to be helpful to George, but is that truly all that could drive someone to be in such a stressful and awful situation?
So that scene that I just read, Orwell does describe it twice, actually, quite briefly, in Homage to Catalonia. And what he says about it is, his takeaway from that is that even when under control, under Stalinist, Russian Stalinist control, the Spanish police are still Spaniards, and therefore it's too much for them to turf a woman out of bed, and because their Spanishness makes them decent fellows. So he doesn't see her cleverness in hiding the checkbook and the passports under the mattress, nor this great interpersonal charm she must have had to keep 6 men from turfing her out of bed to find what was underneath it, nor her courage in the face of that kind of terror. So I have told it from her point of view, if you like, even though the point of view that we've had about it, a scene that intricately and intimately involved her, she was still erased from by her husband, so that was interesting. We do know a great deal about Eileen, really, but about why she went to Spain, perhaps not so much. I think she was looking for adventure. After they got married, she wrote her first letter to her friend Nora 6 months after the wedding. She and Orwell were living in a tiny, decrepit cottage in a village outside of London called Wallington. It's a cottage with no hot water, one cold tap, outdoor loo, no heating. And she was doing all of the intellectual kind of support work and then all of the domestic support work. And at the end of that year, they went to see his parents, and she finally found time to write her first letter to her best friend. And she wrote, "Dear Nora, I'm sorry it's taken me so long to write to you. but we have quarrelled so continuously and really bitterly since the wedding that I thought I'd just write one letter to everyone once the murder or separation was accomplished. So what she doesn't tell Nora in that letter is that Orwell is going off to Spain in the next weeks. And I was very interested in what she told Nora and what she didn't tell Nora. So, you know, my gut feel is she had very good political instincts. She had anti-fascist political instincts. But also she had a lot to flee, you know. She was left there in the cottage looking after the goats and the hens and the garden and trying to boil eggs on a fire. I think she went because she wanted adventure and she wanted to work for the cause. And she said afterwards, I never enjoyed anything more.
Sarah, with some of the writers that you write about in your book, you know, there is a sense that, you know, a lot of them strikingly come from quite well-to-do families, but obviously still hold very passionate sort of socialist political beliefs. But they, we were talking about this earlier, perhaps about their motivations. They're all very varied, but there's also a sense with some of them that you don't know whether their presence in Spain at that time was driven by bravery or perhaps naivety. Could you speak a little to that?
Yeah, well, and I think it can be both, right? Like, they're unquestionably very brave, but whether they kind of realised how brave they were being to go there in the first place is a different question. And I mean, you know, as I said before, that one of the things that interested me about their position in Spain was that they were outsiders. And to me, that seemed to be something that kind of spoke to the position or the natural position of a writer as well. And I was interested to see how all of these people who understood themselves as outsiders managed to kind of hold on to that identity whilst also very kind of openly and clearly and wholeheartedly identifying with a particular side in a conflict. And it was interesting to me also, as you say, how people like Nancy Cunard, who had been born into great wealth and great privilege, could still understand themselves as outsiders, you know, even though they came, you know, they were sort of inhabiting the mainstream and very fortunate people. And I think they were all people who had in some way or another exiled themselves or who had managed to sort of construct lives that enabled them, that allowed them a kind of freedom so that they could kind of pack up and go to Spain at the last minute if they wanted to. And Nancy Cunard was certainly someone who had kind of exiled herself from her own class by being very outspoken about the prejudices that she saw around her. And most kind of provocatively, she had written a pamphlet about her mother's racism that she first circulated as a kind of Christmas gift to all their friends and relatives and then published. And actually what was interesting is that most of those friends and relatives condemned Nancy for kind of attacking her mother in public. So I feel like I've forgotten what your question was.
Well, I guess it's a bravery or naivety in some of their cases.
Yeah.
Some of them had, I guess, by nature of their upbringing and family, had lived fairly sheltered lives.
Yeah, and it's a question of how much they really understood what was happening in Spain as well, I think, because as we were saying earlier, they think of themselves as anti-fascists and they've identified, you know, the cause of Spain as something very specific. But very few of them, you know, Nancy spoke Spanish and Catalan, but Catalan she picked up once she arrived in Spain. Very few of them had a real kind of familiarity with Spain. And they didn't necessarily understand the intricacies of the Spanish political scene before the war or what maybe had led to the war. So again, it's this question of how much are they imposing their own understandings of what Spain means? And what Spain means is such an interesting question to me because it has so many different meanings for so many of the people who were there.
I found... can I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
I found the motivation of Solaria particularly interesting.
Yeah. So Solaria Key was a young nurse from Harlem in New York who volunteered to nurse in Spain. And I also followed Langston Hughes a little bit in the book. And they're both very interesting. I mean, they're an interesting example of how anti-fascism and fascism came to mean a kind of broad range of things. And both of them compared, for example, Franco to the KKK, which shows that they are bringing their own understanding of prejudice. And so, in a way, it's a kind of moment when people are recognizing that these kind of prejudices are structural and they're also, they are international. You know, they're arching over the world and they are ruining the lives of people in many different countries. But they're also bringing issues that wouldn't really be familiar to the people they say that they're fighting for. And the other interesting thing about Solara Q, which I think ties in very interestingly in what you do so brilliantly in Wifedom as well, in kind of trying to reclaim Eileen's own motivations and her own kind of intelligence, is that what people say are Solaria's motivations for going to Spain are not always the same as what she says when she gets given the chance to speak for herself. So she, for example, was later in life spoke very openly about her Catholicism as a reason for going to Spain, which of course didn't sit very well with the anti-clericalism on the Republican side. So to me, that was an interesting way of understanding how when you let these people speak for themselves, you actually have a much kind of more in-depth understanding of what Spain meant and what people's motivations were. And I think, again, something that I love about Wifedom and that I think maybe we're both trying to do is not necessarily, you know, retell a history, but to just recenter it and see, you know, what comes into view when you are not just focused on the famous white men who told this story. And I think it, you know, it reveals a lot more about what the conflict meant. And it also kind of prompts us to rethink our definitions of things like heroism and courage and, you know, what politics is and how it can be done.
I think that there's such an interesting thread between, I think, particularly Nancy and Martha, that there's this, you sense with both of them that they are, I guess, constantly holding themselves to account about what their, you know, what their purpose is there and what their motivations are. And there's a quote in the book from Martha Gellhorn about objectivity. And you know her place as a journalist, essentially. You know, do you just go and observe, or do you have a kind of moral obligation to be showing the world when something is happening? And it's an interesting thing because there's also other writers in your book where there is a sense that perhaps, you know, it almost sounds solipsistic, but I don't think it is, that it is their own sort of sense of like an internal peace that they spoke up when they felt it was right to speak up, that they were there because it was right to be there, that was kind of motivation alone to just feel that they did what was right. Could you, I guess, speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, Martha Gellhorn is somebody who, you know, Spain is her kind of education in war reporting. But she is then somebody who goes on to cover the rest of the, well, not the rest of the, then goes on to cover the Second World War, and she's there when Dachau is liberated at the end of the war. So she's one of the first people to see the concentration camps, and so, you know, although Spain is the beginning of a process that for her ends with that experience in terms of understanding what her role as a journalist is. And she is part of a whole generation of journalists in the 1930s who are really questioning objectivity as a principle for journalists. I think the quote that you're referring to is when she refers to all that objectivity shit, because she really kind of comes to reject it. And I think she, you know, having seen, you know, once you've seen a concentration camp, I think she felt that it was not right to ask her to be objective about something like that, that it would be dishonest for her to put aside her own kind of human reaction, and that it would not be right to seek to find a kind of balance about Auschwitz or Dachau or any of those places is not right. And what was more interesting, you know, the principle that she claimed instead was truth. So she felt that she had a responsibility to truth, not to objectivity. And for her, that was very simple. Her view was that, you know, her role was acting as witness for people who couldn't be in Spain and see civilians being slaughtered or whatever. And that she would report what she saw, she said, without, you know, she wouldn't distort it and she wouldn't tell any lies. And that obviously is kind of oversimplifying the case a little bit, because what she doesn't address is, you know, she may be only writing about what she sees, but she doesn't explain where she chose to look, you know, and it did. There were times when I think she probably had to put journalistic instincts aside in order to write favorably about the cause that she felt was right, which was the Republican side. And that again, I think raises an interesting question for me. To have, you know, writers, you think of them as people who are naturally seeking to complicate things, to look for the nuance, to kind of seek understanding. And I think Spain put them in a very difficult situation, because once you identify with a side and once you become a kind of partisan writer, there is then a question of how much you can question your own side when the stakes are so high. The stakes are, you know, life or death.
And Anna, with George was pretty direct in Homage to Catalonia about his motivations. He was very direct about his motivations for being there. He wanted to fight fascism and what was the direct quote? It was fight fascism and kill fascists. Yeah. But I guess, is there a so much of your book is about the sort of absence of Eileen in Homage to Catalonia in particular. But is there any explanation? Do you buy the explanation that perhaps George omitted her on purpose in order to keep her safe? Because obviously he spent a lot of his life after the war, you know, quite worried about the continued spread of fascism and the possible political repercussions.
Yeah, so he was very concerned with, he was very frightened that communists would come and hunt him down and kill him in Britain. But there was never any sign that that was likely to happen or was going to happen. He had been an infantryman off in the trenches. She would have been a much bigger political goal for that. The idea that George was trying to protect Eileen from anything is an invention. He never tried to protect her. If you read my book, it is absolutely clear. He never tried to protect her from anything at all, ever. That's a sort of chivalrous fantasy made up by people who want to attribute to him something that just isn't clear. One of the things that I think is so interesting about, say, Solaria Key, or Langston Hughes, African Americans going to Spain, is that they see America and Jim Crow then in this different light, and they're sort of liberated a little bit by Spain, would you say? So, and they're linking systems of like the racist oppression in the US. You stop me if I'm getting this completely wrong, with a kind of worldwide capitalist oppression or a fascist fight against fascism and exploitation. So they're seeing systems, illegitimate systems of oppression. Orwell saw that too as a young man in Burma, a racist system. So he couldn't afford to go to university, so he went and was a policeman in Burma between the ages of 19 and 25. And he came out of that with this very interesting and to his life and work crucial insight. He said that the empire, which was founded on this really appalling racism meted out in Burma that he had seen and been part of, the empire is a system of despotism with theft as its aim. So that's the beginning of the education of Orwell into systems of oppression before he goes to Spain. But I guess he never applied that to gender relations. Mm. So he never thought that having a vast amount of work allocated to you because of your gender as a woman or being entitled to that work because of your gender as a man was part of a vast system of despotism with theft of work and life and time as its aim. So I was very interested when I was reading Sarah's book at these at the way that the African Americans who are so live to Jim Crow are then looking at these systems of oppression and Orwell as well, but you know, the fundamental thing underneath all of them is what's happening. If you look at it from the woman's point of view, is what's happening with women, and Sarah is doing that. So that was fascinating.
I think there's a quite interesting thread in both your books that both of you bring in the impact of current world events on both of you on a personal level, and how, you know, you're writing about sort of writers and motivations while also kind of detailing your own motivations in the books. The same way, was there anything about the process of writing these books that for both of you clarified, I guess, your need to take sides, to speak against injustices, or speak against, you know, speak up for what is right by your own definition publicly because of your status as a writer?
I feel like I start any book with questions and I pursue the questions and I don't always feel like I need to come to answers. There were certainly ways in which I could, I mean, I think I'd talk a little bit in the introduction, for example, about one of my early experiences of protesting, which was when I was, I think, in my late teens or early 20s, and I went on a slut walk in London. I don't know if anyone remembers this, but there was, I think it was a Canadian policeman gave a speech at a university where he warned the young women in the audience. He said, if you want to avoid being raped, you should avoid dressing like sluts. And so there was this big movement of young women kind of protesting in major cities, wearing whatever we felt like, you know, as in, is this okay, or will I get raped in this kind of thing? And I went with some of my friends, they were all women, and we met some of our friends afterwards in a park who were men, or you know, they thought they were men, they were boys. And one of them said to us, we were talking about how many women had been on this march and how brilliant it felt. And one of them said, oh, but it's just preaching to the choir. You know, like all of those people are already persuaded. It doesn't mean anything. And, you know, it took me a decade to think, you know, as is the way with these things, it took me a decade to think of a comeback. You know, I need to, like, track him down. I had to find him on Facebook or something and be like, hey, read my book. I have an answer now. But, you know, I realized thinking about this book and what meant so much to Nancy Cunard and all of these people that actually, you know, sometimes just articulating our defiance is enough. You know, sometimes, or to put it the opposite way, sometimes our silence will be taken as our answer, you know? And so I think that people like Nancy Cunard felt that making a statement was powerful in itself. And although I think that's, you know, I'm not convinced that kind of posting something on Instagram is enough when it comes to activism, I do think that, you know, the last few years, certainly in Britain, in the aftermath of the referendum, and when it felt like so many extremist positions were being expressed in public in a way that I had never seen before, I do think that challenges you to really do the intellectual work of working out where you stand on that question, whatever it is, as well.
And about me,
I think that. So just talking about patriarchy, which is a fiction that we all live in. Because, you know, we all live in patriarchy. As far as we know, there is no other place. And yet, it's a made-up story in order to make men appear, speaking very generally, we love men, we love lots of men, we love individual men, but this is how the system works. Men are central and women are peripheral. And so that, you know, people can say things like women and other minorities in a sentence which makes no sense. Which is just proof of the peripherality and not the centrality of women. And that story of patriarchy which we live in is constructed by omission. So a man is the main character, Orwell is the main character in his life, and for the biographers he's the main character. And for him to be powerful and decent, everything, all the ways in which he relied on women, his feminist and intellectual mother and aunt have to be left out. His extraordinarily clever, brilliant wife has to be left out. Everything that they did for him and everything that he did to her and to other women has to be left out so that it looks like he is the hero of the story. And I think that in microcosm is how patriarchy works. So just telling the story of Eileen and putting her point of view parallel to his both enriches the work when we read his work because we understand him better and we understand also that Animal Farm was clearly the work of the two of them. It's more interesting. And we're not getting just this partial story which patriarchy gives to us, partial in both senses of the word. It's only part and it's favourable to him.
Well, we have a bit of time for questions, so I will just ask a very quick one, just because Anna mentioned George Orwell's aunt Nellie, who I just think is just a fascinating character who I've not obviously heard about before. So I might get her to introduce us to Aunt Nellie, but we'll put the microphone in the middle, and if you'd like to line up and ask a question, please do so. I will just say my little spiel that Adelaide Writers Week has a zero tolerance to racism and disrespectful language. I think all three of us also have that. And if you're asking a question at the microphone, we ask you to keep it civil and also keep it a question. Put a question mark at the end. So while people are organising for questions, can you just tell us about Aunt Nellie?
Aunt Nellie.
So good.
So if you read all the biographies of Orwell, you will not know this because these women have to be left out. But Orwell's mother and aunt were feminists and suffragettes. They were educated in England. His aunt Nellie, to whom he was very close, got herself arrested with the Pankhursts, demonstrating for suffrage. And she ran a literary salon in London, probably more minor than that of Nancy Cunard's mother. But she invited literary luminaries of the day like H.G. Wells and E. Nesbitt and so on to this salon. She was an Esperantist. She, quote unquote, lived in sin with her partner until she married him eventually. He was a radical anti-fascist Esperantist, married him in her 50s. And she and Orwell were very close and had a close correspondence about all kinds of things, including the connection of biology to sex and gender roles. So Aunt Nellie was reading all these things and sending Orwell articles. She supported him in Paris when he was supposedly down and out and so on. So that intellectual heritage of these feminist, they were Fabians as well, so they're left wing, these women that, who brought him up. And he grows up to be an underdog, you know, who sees things from this underdog position and a left-wing position. You would think that feminist left-wing inheritance would be really vital, but no, you read the biographies and we understand that he comes from a long line of rather doltish Scottish Blairs, from a slave owner through to his rather dull father. So that's Aunt Nellie.
Hi there. You're...
Hi, thank you both. My question's mainly for Anna, but I'd also be interested in hearing from you, Sarah, if you have a response. Anna, I was wondering if you could talk about the sense of engagement that you felt, the sort of the relationship, if you like, you felt with Eileen when you were researching and writing her and sort of, you know, bringing her to life so vividly. So, for example, the other day, Dame Mary Beard spoke about having a conversation with the Romans. So how was it for you?
I think all writing, what's really exciting about writing is that you're making invisible things visible, whether that's, you know, interior life, emotional life, that's what it's for, or whether it's actual people. So the process of finding her was incredibly exciting. But I also think that, for me, writing is very close to... it's very close to a feeling of being in love, really. You know, you're spending a very long time with someone who you want to do justice to and feel close to and... want them to be alive. So it's a kind of, I think Eileen was brilliant and hilarious and, you know, self-deprecating to a terrible extent. And I was very interested in all of those things about her and her qualities. Yeah.
Do you want to answer?
Yeah, I think, as Anna says, if you're going to spend a long time writing about someone, you need to kind of enjoy their company. So it's always good if it's someone you admire and, you know, somebody that you want to do justice to, because I think when that's your intention, you can be honest with yourself about what you think their failings might be as well.
Anna, I loved your book. I was really shocked at Orwell's absolute failure to recognise the women in his life, and also his dishonesty about his open TB. And I wonder how many people he killed with TB, considering it wasn't really treatable at that time. But Eileen, I just wonder whether, thinking about her today, it occurred to me she might have been a foot soldier for the patriarchy. What do you think?
I don't understand. A foot soldier for the patriarchy?
Women who protect the patriarchy.
Oh.
She was obviously heavily involved with all of his writing, taking notes, typing it all up. She would have discussed many of the issues with him and allowed herself to be written out of the books when presumably she would have had some input into them. And in doing so, she was in some ways supporting his patriarchal views.
Eileen once said of George that he had a remarkable political simplicity, a quote which one of the biographers found just too difficult and rewrote so that you will read in Sir Bernard Crick's account that Eileen said that he had a remarkable political sympathy. I don't think Eileen... I don't see things in terms of accusing women of supporting the patriarchy. I think that that's not how I think about it. I think she had George's measure. She was at least as smart as him and much better educated. I think what happened to her, I see in more personal terms, in terms of writing, that she... for whatever reason, no one really knows, didn't get the first at Oxford that she wanted. After that, so she didn't have an academic career she would have liked, writing and reading. And I feel that she was, this is very starkly put, but she enjoyed working on his written work. She had the idea for Animal Farm. They worked on that day by day. You read that. It's a complete outlier in all his works, and you hear her voice. And just before she died, she writes a letter to Orwell saying, because she's also supported them financially, and he wants to go to this remote farmhouse in Scotland, and she knows she's going to be doing all the work. And she says, well, it might be possible, and she's thinking about money, it might be possible for me to work from home, as it were. So I think that's code for, I imagine it's code for, I can write my own books and make my own money. So I think she was really using him perhaps as an apprenticeship. And I don't see it, so that's, I see it in different terms, yeah. Until she got her confidence back, because, you know, patriarchy knocks your confidence around.
Hi, this question's for Anna. Seeing Eileen in the way that you could through this research, you mentioned that it makes Orwell's story more rich, but how are you able to look at his writing, brilliant as it is, when these omissions are so, like, frustrating?
I don't think... I was actually talking about this with a friend in London last week who's a writer who's 90, and... this is the hoary old question, I think, of can you still like someone's work when you know what they were really like? And my friend, this 90-year-old writer, said I think it's unfair to expect writers to be like... It's a fiction of the reader's imagination, having been moved by a book, that we want the writer to be some kind of decent everyman superhero with his underpants on the right way, always doing the right thing, and so on and so forth. When, and my friend who said he thinks writers are particularly awful, which I thought was interesting. But I think if you look at, say, 1984, which was written after the marriage was over, so he did that by himself. I think if Eileen had got her hands on it, it would have been 10,000 words shorter and a much better book, but that's by the side of the point. It is a vision of, which is of a world, it's a very important book to us, and it's given to all, you know, 16, 17-year-olds in this country in many schools to read, including my kids. It's a vision of a dystopian authoritarian world of these three competing dictatorships and of mass blanket surveillance. So it's extraordinarily relevant to us. It's also a vision that's paranoid, it's sadistic with rats, it's misogynist with rape and murder fantasies of women, and so on. And to think that the man who pulls from himself that vision that is so important to us in that book is going to be a hail fellow, well-met, straight, decent, everyman, vanilla kind of bloke, is our own... that's our own doing. So we don't, we shouldn't be disappointed when the man who pulls that vision from himself finds those things in him. We wouldn't have the vision without the man. So I think it's a kind of reader fantasy problem rather than an author's iniquity problem. You know, speaking as a massively flawed author myself, this is what I would say.
One last question. We're almost running out of time.
I'm just wondering for both of you that the way the historical perspective of challenging that patriarchal perspective, what pushback have you been getting internationally? Because when in our book club, you know, it was surprising that the older women were actually didn't like this perspective. And I thought it's not the men that were pushing back, it was the women who were pushing back and saying, well, you know, why are you making such a fuss about the woman's perspective? And we're different and we've got a private power and this is the way things are done.
I mean, I had what I thought was quite an interesting debate with my publishers when we were talking about what the subtitle for my book should be. And they were quite keen to include the word women in the subtitle. And I said, I mean, it doesn't. It's one of the few battles with my publishers that I've actually won. And I said, you know, it's not a book about women. You know, this is a book about solidarity, about arts and politics, about the 1930s. You know, it's not about women. And then it was very interesting to me when the book was published that it was understood and read as a book about women. And about women's experience in the Spanish Civil War, in a way that I think, you know, when you read a book about the Spanish Civil War and all you get from it is the experience of the international brigades and the only authors who are quoted are Orwell and Hemingway, you know, that's never called a book about men in the Spanish Civil War. And it was fascinating to me the way that it was so evident to people that men had been marginalised in my book in a way that isn't so apparent when it's the other way around. And I mean, I think one reviewer kind of accused me, I think, of airbrushing Hemingway and Orwell, you know, and I was like, they're both in there, and there are male authors that I follow, it's just that they are not the main story, you know, and that is, I think, it's still something that's kind of novel, and it made me feel like maybe it was still worth doing to, you know, let women speak.
I think the idea of separate spheres for men and women and women having power in the private sphere, you know, that's an idea that is at least 200 years old. I don't think it's very helpful to women. I don't think women have always worked outside of the private sphere, and I don't think that argument, I think we've gone way, way, way beyond that, trying to share power and money and time more fairly in society between women and men. One of the things that's interested me, just actually thinking about what Sarah has just said, is that there were a couple of women who said, oh, you shouldn't be looking at the past 80 years ago through this modern lens. And I, modern kind of feminist lens. And that's such a strange to me thing to say. First of all, I don't have another lens because I'm living here and now and I'm a feminist. And secondly, if we look at, say, another structure of power... and I was also told by someone in the UK that I didn't understand British middle-class mores. This was about Orwell pouncing on women and sexually assaulting them. And that was the way things were done then. And essentially, I should just be quiet about that and kind of understand it. So those arguments are the same. Don't use your current day lens to be judging our rape culture, because it wasn't rape culture, because it was just what happened then, basically, or exploitation of women or whatever. And if we look at, say, slavery, we don't look back and say, look, it was just the way it was then. And they thought it was okay then, and who are we to judge? We don't do that, because what that does is absolutely refuse to see the point of view of the enslaved as human. We're taking essentially the point of view of the oppressor. And I think to do that with regard to women is an absolutely analogous thing. If you say, nothing to see here, it was all okay. Well, it was all okay for whom? I don't think it was okay for Eileen, and that's why I've told her story.
Thank you so very much for joining us today, and we'll ask you to support both Anna and Sarah by purchasing their books in the book tent. Their books from this session will be at the quick sales counter, and there will be a book signing after this. But please join me in thanking them.